was thinking the other day, because I only think one every other day, about how cold it is where I am. Because if you're only going to think sometimes, you should spend those thoughts on the things that matter, like the weather. So I was thinking about the cold, and how many people around me are griping about the cold. Is it cold like that where you are? The sort of cold where your hair turns to a frozen block if you dash from the shower to outside because you've overslept again, because the bed's so cosy and your blankets are so toasty? That sort of cold? Well, I'll give you a secret. I really like that sort of cold because it allows you to look for those ways to be more toasty. And one of those ways is to sit inside all wrapped up and read a story. So, good evening. It's Wednesday, March 7th, 2007, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. One's Ship by Barton Midwood. I am up to my calves in the sea, the very beginnings of the sea, which stretches before me out to the edge of the sky. My ship, my tiny ship, moored in the shallows, rocks back and forth anxiously like a schoolboy. The waves lap at its side, the cool waters. Ah, let us go, let us set forth, my ship. But I am detained. All the women have gathered on the beachhead. We must deal with them, my ship and I. All want to make passage with us. They are shrieking, moaning, imploring. Each woman presents a plaintive, convincing case. Each, it is clear from their arguments, deserves, beyond the shadow of a doubt, to accompany me. They love me, they cry. Of course, I am irresistible. My rudder is golden, my sails ample. I have shapely legs. On the beach, with the wind blowing in my thin hair, I make an appealing picture. I am the captain of a noble craft, of everything, in fact, in sight. I am the only man for miles around. I am needed, that's clear. But how should I take them all, these lovely creatures? There is room for but one companion, and frankly, I am loath to take anyone beside myself. I am selfish, utterly. The wind blows in my hair. I turn to them and raise my arms for silence. I shall speak. A hush falls. All eyes grow round and soft and fix me tenderly. The tears flow. It is touching. The back of my shirt bellies like a sail. Ladies, I say, I should like to speak to you individually. Form a line. They fight for first place. They pull one another's hair. They make an undignified spectacle. At last, however, they are in single file, a long line that runs back from the shore, across the beach, out to the road, and to the ends of the earth, for all I know. Nevertheless, I shall give them audience, each one. I must be fair. I bid the first come forward. Yvonne, I cry, come here, my dear. I love you passionately. Let me touch you. I caress her thighs. She throws her arms round my neck, and we kiss so unquestionably, long and hard, that we fall to the ground and roll in the sand. We have no regard. One forgets oneself. There is nothing to be done. Have no fear, I whisper as we stand up and brush the sand from our mouths. You are the one. I shall take you with me. She kisses me lightly on the forehead, holding my face in her hands and standing just on her toes. Then she retires to a shady spot beneath a palm and waits contentedly. From her purse, she takes an orange and sucks it. She stares at me over it from under lowered, loving brows. Next! Elsa steps forward. She runs at me, leaps into the air, locking her legs round my waist, wraps her arms round my neck, those slender tan arms with the light down, and kisses me precisely on the lips. "You are the one," I whisper. "Have no fear." She too retires to a palm and sucks an orange. They have all brought oranges. It must be the season. Shy and blushing comes Natalie. She looks at the ground. She falls in a faint at my feet. I lift her in my arms and lave her forehead with handfuls of the sea. She comes too. "Be happy," she says in a swoon. "I am so embarrassed. All these people, oh, forgive us. I love you so. You are not in debt to me. I shall always love you. You must take whom you please." And then she falls to crying, her lips wet with her tears on my neck. "Natalie," I say, "you are not like the others. I shall take you with me. Have no fear." Ecstatically, she too retires to a palm. She eats an apple, however. She is different. So it goes. 3, 4, 5 days pass in this way, talking, embracing, promising, eating apples and oranges. I have spoken to 1.5 billion women. Yes, I have counted assiduously. I have promised each one that I shall take her with me. It is difficult to say no. How does one say no when one is intoxicated with saying yes? Saying yes is my whiskey. It burns so pleasantly, and after the first few, the rest go down so easily. Yes, yes, yes. It is only no that tastes bitter in my mouth. And what do I care for bitterness? What do I care for? I know, you will say, he is a fool. He does not know how to handle his affairs. He does not appreciate fully the efficacy of saying no. He is a sensualist and cares for nothing but the moment. He has not a practical vision. He will cause nothing but anguish in the world with his infernal yes. And so be it. Say it. I know all that, and I care not. They sit there now, my pretty little 1.5 billion. I face them with my hands on my hips. What now? I could make a dash for the ship, but they would be on me, crawling over my deck before I could hoist the mainsail. They would destroy the ship in a moment. I know something about crowds. I turn my back to them. Bobbing up and down in the sea are the lovely mermaids with the long flowing hair, light green hair with streaks of blonde that shimmer in the sun. Breasts high and firm, bellies silky, these creatures are not half fish as the mythologies say. Under the surface of the waters, from the waist down, they are womanly with sleek, strong legs. The poets have cunningly perpetrated that half-fish business on the public in order to discourage exploitation. "Ladies," I announce suddenly, whirling around, "I must test the ship. I must take a brief spin about the harbour. I shall return shortly, and then the chosen one will join me." This pronouncement seems to disconcert them. There is a sullen, suspicious murmur of disapproval. I walk very cautiously to the ship. I make no sudden movement that might alarm them. I walk slowly, slowly, cautiously, as a man who walks past a mad dog. I attempt to make myself invisible. I hold my breath. The mainsail is up. I push off. I glide upon the waters. I am safe, free. I glide, glide, I laugh, I wave my handkerchief in farewell. I am safe. Out of touch. The mermaids beckon me with their arms, their heads tilted slightly upward. They burst into a chorus of song, an ethereal song, fathomless and sea-struck. I cannot whistle the tune, but I hear it in my dreams, every note I know. I have heard it, every note, before. Why, then, can I not whistle it? I am not a bard whistler. In fact, I am rather musical. I know, like the palm of my hand, the music at the bottom of things. There is a rustling sound below, footsteps coming up the ladder from the hold. A woman climbs on deck. She has a child cradled in her arms and a fierce expression in her eyes. Of course, one hopes beyond hope. There is no escape. One knew it all along. The mermaids make piteous lament. Their song is swallowed in the roar of the sea. There is a storm coming out of the west. There is always a storm coming out of the west. One accepts that. One never examines one's ship carefully enough. One escapes the beach. One escapes half the world. But one never looks thoroughly enough into the nooks and crannies of one's own ship. One is a shithead. One hates oneself. One is not one. One is multitudinous. Well, says one, what the hell are you doing here on one's ship? And who's the brat? Never mind. Take the raft. Paddle yourself back to shore. One is displeased. Do you hear? Displeased. Without a word, she loosens the chains from the raft and kicks it into the sea. The raft, I cry, what have you done? She says nothing. Her eyes accuse me. One is made to feel guilty by those eyes, and then the brat sets to howling. A vicious, discourteous little monster. And then the storm is coming out of the west. One has set off. One is on one's voyage. I sit on the deck, hang my hands limply over the edge. The mermaids kiss my fingertips. I go on, but I know not where I go. A return to the beach is out of the question. I entertain thoughts of pushing the stowaways overboard, but they are tenacious. And then, perhaps, yes, perhaps I need them for ballast. I comfort myself with these thoughts. I contrive reasons for needing them. That is how one's mind works. One has them. One cannot rid oneself easily of them, at least not without committing a heinous crime, so one contrives reasons for needing them. One always needs what one has. If ever one allows oneself to think one does not need what one has, then one is...